This is from the Midwest City Free Baptist Church.
So we are still in it, and we're still in chapter 2. And I want to read a little bit of this from the book of Hebrews, if I can make this thing work right. I have it here, you have it there, and if you want to look it up in any Bible that you have handy, including the ones under those seats, feel free to do so. But here it is in the old typical ESV that we sometimes, or actually frequently use. Hebrews chapter 2, and I'll start in verse 5, and here is what that says. For it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the Son of Man that you care for him? You made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside his control. At present, we do not see everything in subjection to him, but we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus, crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone. Such is God's word. In this part of this letter, just this section of it, the writer here has reasoned something like this. It'll sound a little familiar from the last time we were here. The writer has reasoned kind of like this. If the word of God came, if the word of God came before, a long time ago, by way of angels to some extent, and using prophets, and in various ways and times, if that word that came through all those years was divine, was authoritative, proved to be true, and was serious, and to be taken seriously enough so that you had better heed that word. If that's true, then he reasons to the present to say, what about this revelation? What about this word of flesh and blood in the form of his own son? What if we ignore that word? What if we just don't care about that? What if we just neglect that? How much bigger is the problem we face if we're foolish enough to neglect that word, given what we saw play out when those who were foolish enough to do so didn't heed the word that came by angels and through prophets? That's his reasoning. And he will now use that to kind of take it a different direction, a little transitional four there, to say, and look, here's another thing about the angels and a distinction here. Which of the angels did he say this to or that to? And then it comes a comparison. Now, to do this, he's going to do something that he likes to do, which is quote some Old Testament. Because the writer, the book of Hebrews, knows the Old Testament. I say that, and then you say, oh, does he? Because he doesn't even identify what he quotes. He says it's written somewhere, like maybe he don't know where. I don't know if he knows where, but that's what he does here. I kind of like this, actually. I always thought, got a kick out of the fact that it says, it has been testified somewhere. And literally, what it says there, at least in the Greek, it says, as two words, it says, someone has said somewhere. So it's got actually two kind of. And of course, the someone could also just be one, like one has said. Now, before you think, oh, this guy, you know, he's such a great scholar in the Old Testament, and he knows the Hebrew Scriptures so well, and yet he just says, yeah, written somewhere. That's the way we do, isn't that? That's what we do all the time, right? Don't people always say, hey, doesn't it say somewhere that, Christians do this a lot. We're talking about the Bible. We can't find it. I do it all the time. I can't remember where. Hey, isn't that Ephesians where he says, you know, maybe I get the book. We do that a lot. It makes you not feel so bad when the writer of Hebrews does it, you know? And by the way, I mean, in case you're down on yourself, I happen to think, this is one man's opinion, okay? I happen to think it's not the biggest thing in the world if you can't index it. I mean, it's good to be able to index it. That's why chapter and verse was wisely instituted, to kind of help us find stuff fast and know where it is. That's good. But if you have to choose one, I mean, it's more important that you actually know what it says just then that you can find it someplace fast. It's good to find it fast, but the indexing of it is of slightly less important than the knowledge of it, if that makes any sense. So don't feel too bad if you can't always get chapter and verse and nail it, like, that's chapter 3, verse 18. Maybe you do, maybe you can do that, maybe you can't do that. But hopefully, like this writer, you at least know good and well that it does say that. That is Scripture. I mean, it was revealed. It did say that, and I did get the words right, even if I can't quite remember which chapter that fell in. And incidentally, I mean, it's not as if this is the only place where the reference isn't given, because you have other places. Even Jesus says, it is written. He doesn't always tell you exactly where. But we know where, and everybody who knew their Scriptures would have known where. So where is it from? It's from a psalm. So let me show you Psalm chapter 8, where he comes from. Now, what he quotes there in Hebrews, I'm backing up one verse just to give you a little more fuller context. And now the animal amens come pouring in. I would blame someone for that, but it would have to be me. Well, this chapter then, just to back up one verse, here's what you have. The psalmist says this in chapter 8. He says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have set in place. Okay, so that's the setup. When I consider those things, here's the question. What is man that you are mindful of him? Or the son of man that you care for him? You kind of see what's going on. You see how he sets that up? When I consider all this, then I think, I insert that into the text myself. I mean, what are we? What are we after all? And of course, you get a little bit of this Hebrew, what they call Hebrew parallelism, the way that's put. You're familiar with it, right? Bible readers, this little poetic device, how you say one thing and then sort of for emphatic effect and sort of poetic effect, you say it again, slightly tweak it, right? I am neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet. You see that a lot. So here he says, what is man that you're mindful of? And what is the son of man that you care for him? That is Psalm 8. That's what is quoted here. And so the point of it is that you have a comparison here with angels. One thing, we talked about angels last time, their main purpose, their role as messengers. But now one thing we know for sure that, I mean, at the very least we could say this, and this would be clearly agreed upon, I think, by everyone. Angels are not men. Angels are not human beings. They are different. Jesus, the eternal Son, did not become an angel. He became a man. So this man business, this idea of what is a human being, it's an important question. Not only, of course, is it a grand philosophical question that people all over the world have always contemplated, but from our point of view, even just in the scope of biblical thinking, it's an important theological question because it is tied up with other things. So, for example, the significance of just the whole act of Jesus taking on flesh, the incarnation, right? The Word became flesh. That whole thing is related in its significance to the question of what is a man anyway? Jesus became one. What is one? He took on flesh. What does that mean? What are we anyway? This is good self-reflection. We do self-reflection. Sometimes we ask, who am I? But this is a bigger question. It involves who am I, but it's on a bigger scope because it's, what am I? What kind of a thing am I? What is my nature anyway? So let's take the question and consider it for its own sake. The question of what is man? Let's consider what this means. And the first thing, just important that we go ahead and say this, about the wording. Just about the wording. It's my chance to get the Greek in too, see? About the wording. The rendering of the word man in English, in this case, does not mean male. Not in this case. Now, we know this all too well from any reading you did anywhere in school, that the word man has had the sort of two ideas. Man can mean a dude, you know, a male. But man can also have this larger meaning to refer to humanity, or sometimes we call mankind, that is the human race. Well, the Greeks, as they often do us a big favor, they got two words. You know, and so these words, and this isn't, I mean, there's a little bit of wiggle room always, but generally speaking, these words cover these two meanings. In the New Testament, sometimes when you read man, you're looking at the word anthropos. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Anthropos. Is anthropology the study of guys? The study of dudes? No. Anthropology is just the study of all human beings. Their ways, their thoughts, their culture, their custom, their way, all that. It's all human beings. Anthropos doesn't refer to men, males. It's the general catch-all for human beings. And it's the word, by the way, most commonly used. It's used way more times when you see the word man. And a lot of translations today will change it, as a matter of fact. A lot of modern translations clarify this so that there's no confusion. So that you don't think that it's just, wow, so much of this applies only to men. Bible doesn't hardly has anything to say to women. But the fact is, most of the time, it's just referring to everybody. Now, there is the case, there is the word, the Greek term aner or andro is one of its forms. We'd be more familiar with that. That form of it, right? That refers to males. And every time you see, for example, husbands love your wives, that's literally the word men. There's not a word for husband or wife. It just says men and women. So it means men love your women, but it says men. It's saying males. Of course, that, you know, might be considered controversial today in some places, but that's what he means. You have both words used. But here in our passage, what do we have? Well, I'll show you exactly what it looks like, actually. Just cut and paste it for you. There it is. The question that is asked in this verse in Hebrews, quoting a psalm, but here it's being quoted, so it's in Greek. It is this question. It looks just like this. It reads like that. Ti estin anthropos is what it says in Greek. Ti estin anthropos. And those are the three words. It's what is man? That's pretty easy, right? Not only have I now taught you a Greek word, I just taught you a Greek sentence. Next week we'll move on to a paragraph. I'm just kidding. So, and by the way, this is why, the fact that it uses this word, again, this is why some translations, the NIV, for example, says, what is mankind? That's what it says. You'll see a few versions that might say things like, English versions that might say things like, what are mortals? That's what a couple of them say. And then in one case you've got this sort of almost awkward sentence here. The New English translation says, of what importance is the human race? That's how they do it. You get the idea, though. That is our question. That's what the psalmist asked, and especially in light of the entire vastness of everything and the splendor of it, he's saying, what is man? Now, this hints at something. If I were to ask you a question, if I were to say, you know, when it comes to human beings, does the Bible have, in the teaching of the Bible, does the Bible take a high view of man? Or does it take a low view of man? Think about that question. Is it a high view? Because different belief systems or people of different worldviews might take a different approach. Some people's overall philosophy of things, their whole structure of belief, might place man in a higher place, might have a higher view of human beings, a higher anthropology, as it were, right? They would see people as maybe gods of a kind. Great, having greatness, being almost like little gods of us. I mean, very high and lofty view of who and what we are. Other views might see people as not much, as not very significant, of not very impressive, a lower view of who and what we are. It's a good question to ask. What do we make of the biblical teaching? And in particular, because we have heard a lot of teaching, and it seems to me that especially those of us in a tradition that has been pretty strict about sticking with biblical interpretation. I mean, you can get outside of the Bible's parameters and then who knows what you teach. I mean, sky's the limit. But if you're trying to stay within Bible teaching and keep it on the main highway of what the scripture says, my guess is that our primary instinct at first is to think of the teaching about man that condemns us. In fact, or that says we're small. That's what the psalmist is hinting at in his question, is he not? When I think about all this, I think, what are we? What am I? I mean, why should you care about this little peon down here who frankly messes everything up that he touches? Why would you care about him? That's an element. If you think only about that, you'll think, oh yeah, it's a low view, I guess. Not only that, I mean, we're sinners. I mean, we've botched everything. And we continue to do so. And what about all that stuff about we're worthy of judgment? Is that true? Yes, that's true. Are we depraved? Yeah, we're depraved. So maybe it's just a low view. We're used to that teaching. We're familiar with it because it's true. But could there be another element to this? Is there any sense in which we could say, well, maybe there's a high view? Of course, the important question isn't necessarily, is your view a high view or a low view? When you really get down to it, I want to know, my emphasis is, and what matters to me is, and it should matter to all of us, I think, is it a true view? I mean, ultimately, that's what you want. Is it a true view? Is it the view that really accurately represents who and what we are? And if it's high, it is, and if it's low, take it for what it's worth. Well, there's another element to the biblical teaching that also says there is a high view. So in a sense, you know, when we think about grand stories, there's always the representatives of us at our best and us at our worst. Most of the stories you read about and watch, most of the all superhero movies, everything, it shows you at our best, it shows us at our worst. All the myths, all the tales, everything. You have representatives of the best qualities of people and of the low, worst qualities of people. And so then you say, well, which is closer to accurate? Which one of those represents us the best? What are we more of? Are we more Gandalf or Gollum? You know what I mean? There you have it. And the answer is both. There are places where we read that we are, as it said, a little lower than the angels. That's what the psalmist is. A little low. That's not bad. I mean, angels are pretty impressive. We're just a little below that. I'll take that. That's a pretty good spot. And crowned with glory and honor, that's a high view. That sounds very high. Not to mention the fact that of all the creatures that were made, man was special. The sort of apex of the whole thing after it's all said and done, the last being. And everything else sort of made for him, really. Everything else kind of surrounding him, and he gets the privilege. Hey, I'll give you stewardship. You're kind of going to rule this on my behalf. That's a high view. You bear my image. Let us make man in our image. So there is a fundamental dignity, a value, a worth that human beings have. That is a high view. But there is that other side. So one of Job's friends put it like this. How much less man, it's sort of in the middle of a sentence, who is a maggot, and the son of man, who is a worm. There's that parallelism, right? Again, a maggot? A worm? That doesn't sound like a compliment. No, it's not a compliment. So in one sense, the answer to the question that about the Bible's teaching is that in one sense, we have a high, high view. Because we have this worth bestowed upon human beings. It is a fundamental value. It is the true basis of human rights, by the way. People can try to ground human dignity in a whole bunch of other things. I think it's a failure. Philosophically, I don't know where you derive universal human rights just out of thin air. I mean, the view of human beings on a materialist scale is it? What are we? By hook and by crook, over a long process of time, and about 1,000 lucky chances, here we are. But we were unplanned, and there's no soul indwelling. I mean, there's nothing. What do we have of value besides some capabilities, some superior capabilities? But the Christian view can ground human dignity, can ground human rights, can take a high view and say, no, human, you can't, murder is a capital crime and is the highest form of crime. And why is that? Because you have killed an image bearer. And that's serious business. That's a grave sin. You cannot take that life. It's not the same as killing the cockroach in your house. Because one of them is just a creature. But one of them is special. One of them is different. One of them, you are not allowed to take that life without proper justification. And that's those are some very narrow parameters. So then, in some respects, it's a high view. But in the respects we know, it is a low view. But it's interesting when we think about it. I think sometimes we are leery of the tendency of man to exalt himself. And we should be. Because one of our great sins is our arrogance. But we're so afraid of that sometimes that we can shy away from recognizing fully just what a splendid creature man really is. I mean, God's work was pretty impressive work to make a thing like you. You may say, oh, well, I'm nothing special. Yeah, but you're a pretty amazing machine, you think about it. And just throughout history, when you consider the overwhelmingly impressive works people have accomplished. Think of the genius, the overall collective genius, the progress, all the great works, the monuments of achievement, the legacy, the accumulated wisdom that's been passed down, and just the mastery of so many things. I mean, just the building of civilizations, volumes of stuff left behind for us. It is impressive that someone who is so flawed could have managed to accomplish so many things. It's because that's our image kind of coming through. The ability we've shown to do that, we're kind of showing our parentage like this. We're sort of reflecting who made us, doing things that no other creatures could have pulled off. Give them six times the amount of time we've been around. Give them a million times the time we've been around. The porpoises aren't going to get it done. They're smart, but they will not. There will never be great works hanging in the great museums, okay, by the dolphins. It will not happen. So it's interesting we see this juxtaposition of these two things, these two sides of us. And so you get someone like, for example, Blaise Pascal. And I'm not quoting a Frenchman because I'm rooting for France in the World Cup. It's coincidence. Don't read anything into it. If I had a Croatian guy I could quote, maybe I would. But Blaise Pascal says this about man. He says, what a chimera is a man. It's a cool word, huh? What a novelty. What a monster. What a chaos. What a contradiction. What a prodigy. Judge of all things. Feeble earthworm. Depository of truth. And a sink of uncertainty and error, both the glory and the shame of the universe. And later Pascal says, you know, Christianity is a strange set of doctrines because he says, on the one hand, it bids us recognize that we are vile, that we are worm-like, and even abominable in some cases. And then on the other hand, it tells us that we have God's image and that he would die for us and that we should strive to be like him. And what Pascal says in that second passage, he says, you know, this is a good tension because without this counterpoise, as he calls it, on the one hand, we might have too much arrogance because look at us. Look who made us. Look who cares about us. Made everything. Brought us about. We have his image. We could be horribly vain, he says, if we didn't watch out. Or on the other hand, if we didn't have this other tension, the sinfulness of man, the sheer depravity, the judgment that comes our way, the thousand times we're told, you know, how wrong we've gotten it, he says, could also lead us into absolute, you could just plunge us into depression as a race of people. We could just be miserably abject. We're worthless. We could have the ultimate daddy issue, all right? Just spend our whole lives thinking, the one who made us hates us forever because we are the biggest screw-ups of all time. But so Pascal says, it's sort of good that we have the balance of the two sides. Keep us from getting too full of ourselves and making us dependent upon God, but also keeping us from falling off into the pit of total despair and giving us the kind of assurances and promises and a true sense of self-worth. Are people struggling with their self-worth in the world? Is this a problem for people? Their identities, their picture of themselves, there's the psychology of trying to love yourself. Is that an issue today? That is a huge problem. If you just look around, you'll see that people are just wallowing in all of these sort of almost narcissistic, self-absorbed. They hate themselves, so they find every which way to try to love themselves more. If we ground our worth where it should be grounded, we'll be stable. We'll have a sound mind. You can know yourself, and you can admit your faults without hating your own guts. It's not the easiest thing, but it's the truest thing. And so maybe the best quote, of course, of all that reflects this kind of thing, I can't do this without quoting the bard himself. And so you remember now, this one you'll remember from Hamlet. No, I don't remember Hamlet. You betcha, I bet you do. When he says these words, it'll come back to you. What a piece of work is a man. Remember this one? What a piece of work is a man. How noble in reason. How infinite in faculty. In form and moving, how express and admirable. In action, how like an angel. In apprehension, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals. And yet, to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me. Now, he was in a bad state of mind at the time because he was really dwelling on some really rotten, nasty, terrible things that some people did, and he wanted to kill them for that. So, you know, sometimes, are there days when your view of people kind of goes up or goes down, depending on who you've been around or what they've done to you on that given day? Some days you love people more and some days you hate them all. Now that's the roller coaster ride of emotion. But I think the quote reflects accurately what we can learn from a psalm that then comes back in the words of the writer of Hebrews to ask this question. Man, as a matter of fact, you, me, all of us, we are both things. And Jesus became one of us. And in that sense, he became, to that extent, both things. He fulfilled all of the potential of our greatness. Everything that could be great about us, he was able to maximize. He was able to score a perfect 10s across the board. And we're all somewhere in, I don't know, I'll give most of you 6 and 7.5s. I don't know, let's not get too overconfident here. I'm like about a 4. But I'm just saying, we're trying. He's 10s across the board, showing the maximum score to demonstrate all of our greatness while overcoming the depravity of our race, tempted in every way, and yet able to conquer. So he leads the way then in that sense, the firstborn. He's the example. He was lower than the angels just for a little bit. In his flesh, he was lower than the angels, willing to suffer the pain and death of this condition, willing to taste death for all of us. But now, crowned with glory and honor and given a name that surpasses all other names. Now everything is truly in subjection to him. See, that's the path that he's blazed. You too show up here a little lower than the angels. But you too have promises. A bold promise, okay? A bold promise that you can reign with him. That you, someday, everything likewise can be in subjection to us. That's a big one. You see now why this is considered so great a salvation that you shouldn't neglect it and ignore it and forget it and just stop caring about it and never think about it and throw it overboard or set it aside. That's why, because this is a path that I want to be on it. I want to stay on it. I want to follow the trail blazed by the man among all men, by he who was ultimate anthropos, because he was God. He was theos and anthropos. He was the God-man. And so that is the path. That is why we will not, must not, cannot neglect so great a salvation as this. Because what is man? We are both. We are both, at least for a little while.
Say whatever things are lovely, whatever things are true, whatever things are of good report, if there be any virtue, let us think upon these things. Let God be true and every man a liar. And that is what it comes down to.